There are no neat and pat truths anymore. The world is simply too raw, too complex, too alive, to be cramped into contrived syllogisms. Philosophers have abandoned their attempt to embrace the world with words and thereby to control the world. Since the days of Socrates, men have attempted to define justice, beauty, and goodness. We have found that there are no all-embracing definitions. All that we can do is to define the just, the comely, or the good within a given frame of reference and within a given set of circumstances. In the Middle Ages, a Thomas Aquinas could believe that all questions could be answered, and indeed that he had answered most of the questions. Today, we are far from sure that we can even pose the questions themselves. Until recent times, philosophy tended to speak rather doctrinarily and arbitrarily. Today, philosophy speaks in terms of dialogue, of paradox, of polarity, of what the philosophers call the complementarity of opposites. And the philosophers today wonder at the obtuseness of men who continue to bloody each other around the neck and the shoulders and the head in the belief their ideology is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Now, we Jews are not surprised to see the world turn away from the attempt to find a complete and whole system, a worldview consistent in all its parts, which men need simply affirm and accept. This has never been our way. Judaism has always taken a rather balanced and open view of life. We affirmed ritual and the prophetic attack on ritual. We affirmed man's potentiality and also man's animality. We affirmed discipline and the virtue of pleasure. And it was not at all unlikely for a bitter and acrimonious rabbinic debate to end with this formula: Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. Both this man's point of view and this man's point of view, though they may seem to you at first blush to be contrary and opposites, are the words of the living God. I want to speak to you this morning of three grand teachers of our century who dedicated their lives to erase from our thought and from our actions dogmatism, doctrinaire positions. Albert Schweitzer died at the age of 90. Martin Buber died at the age of 87. Paul Tillich died just a few months short of his 80th birthday. And to the very end of their lives, these three men resisted the temptation to assert that their teaching was the truth. And to the very end of their lives, these men dedicated mind and heart and soul to search out truth. Albert Schweitzer wrote for all of these men when he phrased in his book, The Philosophy of Civilization, this thought: the stupid arrogance of thinking ourselves civilized has lost its power over us. We face the truth that with so much progress and knowledge and power, true civilization has become not easier, but harder. We will have to struggle with circumstance to preserve our humanity. We must be anxiously concerned to turn our knowledge towards hope. Let me tell you a bit about the uniqueness and the teaching of each of these men. Albert Schweitzer was born in Kaisersberg in Alsace, which was then part of Germany, into the home of a Lutheran minister. He received a sound and thorough education, as only a German education can be thorough and sound. And he was an apt, indeed a brilliant student. By the age of 30, a At a time when most men are beginning to round into their talents, Schweitzer had already written classic studies, classic books, the great German figures Kant, Bach, Goethe. He had been critically acclaimed as one of the leading organists on the continent, and he was the dean of the most important faculty in theology in Germany. Before he was 30, he had written a book in religion, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, which was probably the most important, certainly the most debated volume in religion in the first half of this century. German historians had been the first to apply the critical teachings of history to scripture. And it had become immediately clear that the miracle stories which are woven into the biography of Jesus and the myths which surround his miraculous birth and his miraculous death were later additions, accretions, to his biography. A number of ministers and theologians had gone on from there to assert that Christianity did not depend upon the miracles nor upon the myth, but upon the man. That it was the heroism and the nobility of the man Jesus which Christians followed. And it was the teaching of the man Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, which they affirmed. Now, Schweitzer approved of the liberalism and the forthrightness of this position, but he felt that these ministers based themselves on a false historical foundation. He reviewed one by one each of the attempts to reconstruct the man Jesus, and he concluded that Jesus' biography had been so handled so often, and so twisted and reshaped and resculpted, that the man could no longer be resurrected from behind the mists of history. That all that one could say about Jesus was that he had lived, and that he was a messianist and a millenarian, that he believed that the last judgment was at hand, that his days were the end of days, and that he preached an ethic for this special time between history and God's era. He preached an ethic to leave behind you your business, to walk away from your home, from wives, from responsibility, to go out in the desert, there to pray and to fast and to prepare yourselves for salvation. Now, Schweitzer asserted that Jesus did not provide a model on which the Christian might model himself simply because we did not know the facts of his life. And that the Sermon on the Mount was not an ethical model for the Christian because it was an ethic for the end of time. And the end had not come. And modern man lived within time. On what then could Christianity be based? On the spiritual personality of Jesus. On his sincerity. On his commitment. On that which reveals itself in the spirit of the gospel. The spirit of a man who was wholly dedicated to God, who devoted his whole life, his body and soul, to serve and to suffer for mankind. At the age of 30, Schweitzer stood at the threshold of an assured career. And as you well know, he deliberately turned his back on these honors and on that career. He returned to medical school to prepare himself to be a medical missionary. And in 1913, he sailed for Lambarine in Gabon, in Equatorial Africa, where he established a hospital which ultimately made him world famous, and where he began to serve and to suffer, to heal and to cure, to help and to encourage his patients and his friends. And by the end of his life, Schweitzer had become a figure of international reputation, a Nobel laureate, the living symbol of the saintly man. Now, I'd like to dwell for a moment with you on the reasons for this sudden decision to leave off one life to take up another. For I think in this decision there is a lesson for us. Usually Schweitzer's decision has been explained as his attempt to live his theology, as Jesus suffered and served. So he was determined to serve and to suffer. He could not be content simply to teach. He had to reach out to man more immediately and to help man more directly. There is much to this. But Jesus, after all, served in Judea. He preached to Jews. He never left his homeland. Certainly there were many places in Germany where a man could have set up a clinic, where a man could have begun a ministry of healing. Why did Schweitzer go to Africa? The answer, I believe, lies in the nature of the German society and culture of the day. Germany at the turn of the century was the cultural center of Europe. Germans prized learning and education. Never has an academic been so honored as were the Herren Professor. And Germany could claim its share and more of the luminary figures of civilization. There was Heine and Goethe and Rilke in literature. There was Virchow and Koch and Wundt and Helmholtz and Röntgen in science and medicine. There was Ranke and Trelsch and Weber in history. There was Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and Marx, Hegel, Schiller, Kant, and philosophy. Germans were proud of their academics, and every German hoped that his child would pass through the gymnasium, pass through the university, and become a leading figure in the intellectual world. But somehow, all of this intellectual brilliance, all of this educational concern failed to percolate down into the society and to change the nature of German society. The German world remained paternalistic, authoritarian, stratified rigidly by class and by religion. Democracy was not given a chance to evolve. There was no war on poverty. While a few gained the benefits of the society, the many worked in the mines and in the factories at long hours and minimal wages and lived in the most abysmal of conditions. The German mind had already developed this high, arbitrary wall which allowed Hitler to take over the professors. There was a man's expertise on the one hand, and his citizenship was quite another. The academic claimed the right of being apolitical, interested only in his narrow professional area of knowledge, allowing the society to be run by and for the business monopolists and the Prussian Junkers who had run it from time immemorial. Schweitzer set out to use his classroom as a catalyzing agent. Schweitzer was dedicated to a philosophy which he called reverence for life. And by reverence for life, he meant simply this, that every living being, every living organism was created with a spark of divine within it. That any society which fails to allow the individual his dignity, his divinity, which uses him simply as a laborer, as the laboring force, which sees that he is kept apart and aside from the benefit of the age, which denies him education, which denies him civilization, which denies him opportunity. Any such civilization is blasphemous, for it denies the will of God. And Schweitzer hoped that he might catalyze, inspire the young people who sat in his classroom to go out and to be the foretrekkers, the prophets, those who worked to change German society. The German classroom was a passive affair. The students came, and they took copious notes, and they read their assignments, and they returned to the professor his thoughts and their notes and their studies on the examination. And their goal was not to use philosophy and theology as a pattern for life, but simply as a stepping stone to the rank of professor, so that they too might gain international honor, so that they too might in turn command their classrooms to return their lectures and their ideas on an examination. Schweitzer would not play this intellectual game. He was wholly serious about life. He could not find the elbow room, the opportunity in Germany to put his thoughts to life, to be a source of benefit, of change for his nation. So he turned away and he sought another land, more primitive society, in which he could serve and change and better mankind and mankind's lot. And I wonder if we cannot see the analogy here to our own situation. America has recently awakened to the value of education. Degrees are being huckstered about our land as the key to national destiny and as the key factor in personal success. Would that peace and prosperity could be so easily gained. And at the very time that we are encouraging with millions and millions of tax dollars the university, at the very time that we are for the first time giving a certain social status to the academic, are we not seeking to hermetically seal him into his classroom and into his area of technical expertise? Do we not say to him, give us the power that your science can unlock for us? Give us the knowledge that is necessary for our policy, but don't meddle in the policy. Leave the decisions to those who have always made the decisions. And have we not, each of us, already developed a mental block which says that all of the campus protests, all of the academic teach-ins, all of the questions, the searching questions asked by professor and student are simply exuberant, excessive, and that they can be dismissed without thought? And how many Schweitzers will the hermetically sealed classroom, if we create it, drive away from national concern? And are not the Schweitzers the very people, the sensitive people, the creative people, the decent people, whom a nation requires for its destiny? Like Albert Schweitzer, Paul Tillich was raised in the home of a Lutheran minister, and he received in his native Prussia a sound and thorough education, and he graduated a philosopher and a theologian. Tillich's life was lived behind the lecture platform and in the classroom. But unlike most ministers who teach simply the doctrine in which they have been trained, Tillich's life was dedicated to the teaching of freedom, to a breaking away from the paternalism of his home, to the passive quality of a German classroom, to the autocracy of the German state. Tillich invokes again and again in his writings the image of the Grand Inquisitor, which you know from Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov. And Tillich's life was devoted to free Germany, if he could, from this passion for obedience, which pervaded every segment of the German society. Tillich was a liberal. Tillich was a man who marched with his students in Berlin protests. Tillich was a religious socialist, and Tillich was one of the first men marked by Hitler for removal from the university life of Germany. In 1932, Tillich came to this land as an exile, and he found in America the open society which he had dreamed to create or to help create in Germany. And he wrote some 15 years after his arrival here, "There is no authoritarian system in the school in America, as my students taught me sometimes through amusing lessons. There is no authoritarian system in the administration, as the policemen taught me, sometimes through benevolent lessons. There is no authoritarian system in politics, as the elections taught me, sometimes through surprising lessons. There is no authoritarian system in religion, as the denominations taught me, sometimes through the presence of a dozen churches in one village. I saw the American courage to go ahead, to try, to risk failure, to begin again after defeat, to lead an experimental life both in knowledge and in action, to be open toward the future, to participate in the creative power of nature and history." Tillich thrilled to the open society. But in his last years, in the 1950s and 60s, he began to wonder in his writings if the image of the Grand Inquisitor was not beginning to cast its shadow over our land. He was concerned by the rise of McCarthy. He was concerned by the growing intemperance of the American people with dissent. He was concerned with the emphasis on consensus in international policy. And most of all, he was concerned by the rise of a significant minority in our nation who insisted that there was a constitutional model after which all life and all law must be sculpted. Now, there were many men during the first half of this century whose lives were dedicated to breaking the ancient shackles which bound men to medieval and authoritarian ideologies and systems of government. What makes Tillich unique? What made him a religious teacher? Tillich was one of the few men in this century who was willing to look at the terror and the torment, at the convulsion of our life, straight on, and yet maintain an unflinching faith. In the 1900s, mankind's hopes were high. Men were convinced that our science and our learning would engineer for us prosperity and peace. And then came the bloodbath of the First World War. And then came the tumult and the convulsion of the Bolshevik Revolution. And then came the new science of the irrational man. And men lost their confidence. And many men who had been optimistic became pessimists. And many men who had been liberals became cowards. Few were the men who had the courage to hold on to their faith and to find in philosophy and in faith a reason for decency. The 1920s, as you remember, were the age of black, despairing literature, of Dadaism in art, of the theater of the absurd, of intellectuals who crawled back into their ivory tower, of the average man who crawled out into his indulgence. In 1923, Paul Tillich brought out a small but significant volume, which he entitled The Courage to Be. In this volume, Tillich tried to analyze the anxiety and the tension, the sense of meaninglessness which pervaded the age. He argued in this vein. Most men, he said, have been trained to work for goals, for ends, for status, for success, for power, for fame, for fortune. And these ends are rarely achieved, and even if they are achieved, they rarely bring true happiness. Working for ends, man is inevitably frustrated, and frustration leads to despair. Add to this the state of modern man who has outgrown the ancient narrow ideologies of religion, of chauvinism, who has little to hold on to, and you have the black mood of the age. What's for it then? Let man, he said, cease to work for ends. Let him work each day for the day. Worry not about your love, your family, 50 years from now after you are dead, but enjoy your love now. Seek to bind your love tightly to you, to give yourself responsively in love in the moment. To work for ends is to distort our lives. Fathers have no time for their families, parents have no time for their children, and almost no one has any time for his soul. The day, the moment, the immediate moment, this is all we have. Use each day fully. Do what you can now for that which is significant to you. That is the courage to be. That is the faith to say no to despair. To realize that you must die, that there may be terrible war, but that you have used that time which God has given to you fully and wisely and well. Tillich might have taken as his motto that magnificent line from our Book of Psalms, Lo amut ki echye, v'asaper kavod Adonai. I will not die but live and declare the word of the Lord. As an historian and a philosopher of history, Tillich knew that a frightened generation, and our age is frightened, tends to withdraw from life, to become stoic, or to retreat from life, eat, drink, and be merry. He told his classes and he told his congregations again and again, have the courage to be. Have the courage to be men. B'makom she'enish, hishtadel liyotish. In the place where there are few men, have the courage to be men. Like Schweitzer and Tillich, Martin Buber was raised in a deeply religious home and received a sound and thorough German education. Buber's grandfather, Solomon Buber, had been one of the leading scholars and citizens of the Haskalah, the great movement of Jewish enlightenment at the beginning of the 19th century. The young Buber, I think, would have enjoyed the academic world into which Tillich and Schweitzer were initiated. But for all of his brilliance, for all of his trading, he suffered the one disability that Germany would not put aside. He was a Jew. Will it or not, he must make his peace with life as a Jew. And somewhat to his surprise in his early 1920s, Buber found in Judaism a philosophy as modern, as suggestive, as profound as any that he had been taught in university. And he made the teaching of this philosophy the burden of his life. To Buber, all life was alive. Past and present and future were all bound up in the moment. Buber found in the Bible not an ancient literature, not the writings of men who lived 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, but a voice calling out, "Martin Buber, are you listening? Martin Buber, are you responding to these truths?" It is not to Abraham that God commanded, "Get you out from your home, from the prejudices of your background, from the limitations of your environment, march out to your destiny," all the while being concerned to be a man. No, it is to you, Buber, to you, to me, and to all of us. And it was not only to Joseph that God sent an angel, his conscience, to wrestle with him the long night. Each of us wrestles the long night upon his bed between principle and compromise. And it was not to Moses only that the Ten Commandments are given, but to each of us. And the question is not, were the Ten Commandments given at Sinai and were they accepted by the Jews in the desert in those days, but were they given to us here and now, and do we accept them? And do we make them part of our lives? Buber taught this sense of immediacy, of the contemporaneity of Scripture in many a way. He delighted to teach it through the Hasidic tales, which he revived and made popular through all of Europe. He tells, for instance, of a Hasidic rabbi, Schneer Zalman. Schneer Zalman was in prison. We know not the cause. And his jeweler was a country bumpkin, but one of those self-read and semi-literate men who delight to taunt the jailed. Having a rabbi, he taunted him on religion. And he turned to Schneer Zalman and he said, "Tell me, rabbi, if God is all-knowing, how is it that he had to ask Adam in the garden, 'Where art thou?'" Schneer Zalman answered the question with a question. "Jailer, do you believe that the Bible is true for all men?" And being a good Christian, the jailer answered, "I do." "Does not God ask you, jailer, where art thou?" After 40 years of life, his father, his husband, his jailer, his citizen, "Where art thou?" To Buber, all of our interest in the Bible is ancient history. All the lectures we attend on archaeology in the Bible were a jest, distracting, something aside. The Bible represented the living presence of God, a voice reaching out in our generation and insisting, "Respond, listen, hear, commit, assent, abide." Buber, the world was alive, even as the Bible was alive. The world was alive with the presence of God, and man was alive with the presence of God. Throughout history, Buber taught, men have used other men as tools, as pack animals, as slaves, callously, deliberately, and for their special privilege. But man was not created to be a living tool. Man was created in the image of God. There is a spark of the divine in every man. We blaspheme God when we use men to our selfish purpose. Here we come to that now world-famous equation of Martin Buber's. Cease to use men in this relationship of an I to an it. What use can I make of so-and-so? And learn to relate to men in an I-thou relationship. Give to others the same respect you demand for yourself, but more. Recognize that you are all the children of God, all created in God's image, that you must share. Share this world. Share its opportunity. Share friendship. Share love. Share intimacy. Learn
learn to reach into another human being to see his decency. Learn to respond to the presence of God in another human being. A psychologist, Buber, taught us a great deal about the essence of a true marriage, in which people treat one another with respect and yet as a thou, as a person created in God's own image. And as a philosopher and sociologist, Buber taught us much of how the world must be managed, so that we no longer abuse whole groups of men, so that we no longer treat men with charity or with contempt or callously, but each as divine, each as a creature of God. Now, what have these three grand teachers in common? They have a great deal in common. They all grew up in the same Germany, and they all received the same thorough and sound German education. They all were raised in profoundly religious homes, and they all were profoundly religious men. They all had little patience with the dogma and the doctrine of the past. To them, religion was essentially a living phenomena. Cease, they would tell their congregations, to venerate the past. We evoke the past only to vitalize the present. And more than this, and finally, each of these men was ultimately concerned with life. None of them played it cool. None of them followed the easy way, doing what their parents had doing, keeping their noses out of trouble, seeking the minor rewards which timid virtues win for men. Martin Buber, in one of the Hasidic stories, tells of a pupil who asked his teacher, "Where is God?" And the answer was, "God is wherever men will let him in." Most of us lock God out of our lives. Most of us refuse to face up to life as it really is. It's easier to mind our own business, as we say. It's easier to seek for the paycheck, to seek for the promotion, to seek for the goal of the moment, and not to ask questions. Why? Where am I going? What is it really worth to me? What purpose does my life really have? These are frightening questions. They force us to stand on quicksand and to be uncertain whether what we are doing is really worthwhile. Yet each of these men had the courage to face these questions straight on. And their dignity is our challenge. Where is God? God is wherever man will let him in. As they let God into their lives, may each of us allow God into his.